thanks so much for the invitation to come and talk here. I'm excited to be back. I was one of the undergrad students here a summer about 7 years ago, so it's nice to be back. So today I'll be talking about some work that's done with Hong Liu at MIT. It's some work that appeared a while ago, which I'll review mostly for background, and then I'll talk about some work that hopefully should be done in a couple weeks. Okay, great. So first, the setting for this talk is trying to understand, hopefully that works, the ADS-CFT correspondence. Hopefully everybody's heard at least a little bit about the ADS-CFT correspondence, but just so that we're all on the same page, I'll tell you how I'm going to think about it today. So what does the ADS-CFT correspondence say? Well, it says that if I have some quantum gravity system that that has some boundary conditions that make it an asymptotically ADS spacetime, I have some quantum gravity modes, drawn with these blue squiggles here, living on this green disk in the bulk, then whatever that theory is, and of course we don't know what that theory is in general, but that theory should be equivalent to a conformal field theory that lives on its boundary. So here that would be this black circle. Okay. And so, this is an old correspondence. Why is it interesting? Why do people still care about this? I think one reason it's really interesting is that it's a concrete realization of the holographic principle. We have a gravitating system that's living in a higher dimensional space-time, and apparently we can describe it using some lower dimensional conformal field theory. And the other aspect of it that's really interesting and sort of what we're going to get at today is the idea that we can treat gravity as an emergent quantum mechanical phenomenon. So what this correspondence says is that here I have some quantum gravity system that might be very complicated. We might not know how to describe it very precisely. But this conformal field theory, it's a complicated theory, but in principle it's some quantum mechanical system. It's described by quantum mechanics on some space-time. There's no gravity in that theory at all. And so we'd like to understand, what is it about these conformal field theories that lets them describe these higher dimensional quantum gravity systems? Okay, so coming to the way that I want to frame this correspondence today, so roughly the idea of the point of that last slide was to say that we have a bulk gravity theory, and that's supposed to be equivalent to some boundary conformal field theory. So at the highest level, what could this possibly mean? It means that if you hand me some quantum gravity state in your theory of quantum gravity, which whatever it may be, then I'd better be able to give you a corresponding CFT state. And I should be able to do this, in both directions for everything. There's a one-to-one correspondence. So an example suggested by Maldacena in 2001, this is for two copies of the conformal field theory, but what he said was that, if you have these two copies of the conformal field theory, if you entangle them in this thermal field double state, that should be dual to a quantum gravity state that looks like this eternal ADS black hole. Okay, and the thing that I want you to notice on this slide is that the two sides of this picture look very different from each other. So if you look at this right side, it's pretty simple. We have two conformal field theories. They're in some entangled state. But on this left side, we have a classical bulk geometry. That geometry has horizons. It has these interior regions. It has a notion of infalling observers who can fall from one side, cross the horizon. So there's all this complicated sort of geometric information on this left-hand side that, it's not super obvious where that comes from on this right-hand side. Okay. And another thing that I want you to notice about this picture is that what I drew here is, just a classical conformal diagram. This is a conformal diagram of some classical space-time. It's a solution to Einstein's equations that has this conformal diagram that's just a classical geometry. There's nothing, there's nothing crazy or quantum going on in this space-time picture. Okay. So ADS-CFT is supposed to be a correspondence that's true. That's a statement about quantum gravity that has finite coupling constants and correspondingly corresponds to holographic conformal field theories that also have some finite finite parameters that describe them. But the situation in which we understand this the best is in the semi-classical limit. So in the semi-classical limit, this corresponds to taking Newton's constant to zero in the bulk. And if you look at the standard ADS-CFT parameter mappings, that means that you're thinking about a CFT with many local degrees of freedom. So I'll just write this as some parameter n for this talk, but we're going to have a huge number of local degrees of freedom. And if we really want to take the semi-classical limit in the bulk, we should be taking this parameter to infinity. Okay, so it's only in that semi-classical limit that we expect the bulk description to be a genuine classical geometry. And this means that that classical geometry has to emerge from an n equals infinity CFT. Okay? So what is an n equals infinity CFT? That's the sort of question that we're going to try to answer in this talk. Okay. Yes. And in particular, the thing that we're going to be most interested in this talk is the idea of space-time subregions. So there's all this physics that appears in the bulk that has to do with, you know, with there being some local theory that's defined in the bulk. And then in particular, you know, to any space-time subregion in the bulk, I can associate local operators, I can integrate them over that region and smear them and look at their commutators and stuff like that. And there's all this local information. But what's the dual of all of that in the boundary CFT is not always obvious. So we're going to be interested in how does the boundary theory probe local bulk physics. Good. So I want to recast that question in a different way. And this is sort of a question that people who work on ADS-CFT are quite familiar with, is the notion that the spacetime is emerging from the CFT. There's a bulk spacetime. It's got higher dimensions. Somehow that dimension came out of somewhere. How are we describing locality in this extra in this higher dimensional system? And I want to rephrase this question in terms of a math question, and that's what is the precise mathematical structure in the CFT that can describe these geometric objects in the bulk? The bulk has all these, you know, it has extremal surfaces, it has you know, notions of volume associated to space-time subregions, and all this kind of stuff. What is it? What's the mathematical objects and what's the structure of the n equals infinity CFT that lets it describe those kind of objects? So what we'll argue, this is the punchline of the talk, is that the bulk spacetime is a geometrization of emergent type 3-1 algebras on the boundary. So that's a lot of words at this point. But essentially what I want to say is what we're going to see is that, you know, an n equals infinity CFT in some ways does not look really like a finite n CFT. It has many different properties that are very strange from the boundary perspective. But if you think about those properties, if you find a way to map these algebras in the boundary in a reasonable way to bulk algebras, then you'll find that the properties of those emergent algebras that appear in the large n limit of the CFT are really neatly organized in terms of geometric principles in the bulk. Okay. And in particular, these bulk geometric notions can be related to the properties of those type 3 algebras. I guess that's almost the same point. Okay. Are there any questions at this point? That's just sort of where we're going to try to head. Okay, great. So just as a quick outline for the talk, so first I'll just do, you know, a very lightning and very biased review of algebraic quantum field theory, the things that I want you to worry about today. Then I'll talk about how we define these large n algebras and how we define Hilbert spaces that, you know, how do we actually describe the large n CFT? And I'll talk about the properties of the algebras that we get there. And then I'll discuss something called subalgebra subregion duality, which is a generalization of subregion duality or entanglement wedge reconstruction, which I'll use interchangeably throughout the talk. And then I'll talk about how this, you know, this is a generalization, so it had better be able to do something that we couldn't do before. And so I'll talk about some more general cases. And then I'll come to sort of the meat of the talk, which has to do with this additivity anomaly. So I said that when we take the n goes to infinity limit, we end up with algebras that obey some really strange properties on the boundary. One of those is what's called the additivity anomaly. So I want to talk about how this underlies a lot of work that's been done in the ADS-CFT literature. So I'll talk about how we can use volume as a measure to this. I'll talk about its relation to quantum error correction models of holography. I'll talk about a potential generalization of Alex's theorem. Good. Okay. So here's a very biased and you know, non-standard presentation of algebraic QFT. So in algebraic QFT, what we do is we put the algebras of local observables as sort of the main object of study. So what this means is we consider subregions that I'll denote, you know, schematically by R of our spacetime, and to each of those subregions we associate an algebra that I'll denote as B sub R. Now, if we want this to be, you know, a quantum field theory, a relativistic quantum field theory, there are two things that we should probably demand right away. The first thing is that if you give me a subregion that's contained within, you know, a bigger region R2, it had better be the case that the algebra associated to R1 is contained in the algebra to R2. You know, I shouldn't lose operators by taking a larger subregion. Okay. And the other thing that we should definitely impose is what's called causality. So here I'll just pause to explain the notation. So when I have a space-time subregion like R1 and I put a prime on it, this means the causal complement. That's the set of all points on the manifold that are space-like to all points in the region R1. Okay, good. And if I have an algebra and I put a prime on it, this means the commutant, which is the set of all operators in the theory that commute with all operators within this algebra B of R1. Okay, and so so the statement of causality in this setting is that, you know, the operators that are space-like separated to the region R1, they had better commute with the operators that are in R1. Okay, so this is just a statement of causality. There are maybe, and then, so these are sort of the most basic things we demand about the algebraic definition of our theory. But there are additional properties that we might want to impose. So one thing is that our theory might have a local equation of motion. And what this means is that if you give me some subregion that you know may not be causally complete, then the algebra should be equivalent to the algebra in the larger region that's its causal completion. And that's just saying that I can use the equation of motion to evolve operators in the larger region R hat down to operators in the region R. Another property that you might demand, which is a very strong property, is called Hogg duality, which says that this causality is actually saturated. It says that, you know, all of the operators that commute with B of R1, they're all operators that are in this region of R1 prime. Good. So so these are additional things that we might demand of our theory. And depending which theory you have, you know, they may or may not actually obey these properties. That's why I'm separating them. But the one that we're going to be most interested in today is what's called additivity. So additivity is the statement that, you know, if I take two subregions R1 and R2 and I put them together, you know, in a relativistically sensible way by, you know, taking their union and then the causal completion of that the algebra associated to the causal completion of that union is what's called the additive algebra. So I'm going to say the word additive a ton. That's what this V symbol here means. The additive algebra is the smallest von Neumann algebra that contains its sort of constituent parts. So if I want to construct a von Neumann algebra that contains B R1 and B R2, then this is the way that gives me the smallest one. There might be a bunch of other algebras that contain both of those, but this is the smallest one. So let's come to the physical meaning of additivity, because this is what we're going to be most interested in today. So imagine that for simplicity here, I've just drawn some spatial subregion R. Imagine that I want to look at this subregion. Additivity is a very strong form of locality. So what it says is if I take this subregion R and I split it in two like this, then I can take the algebra associated to, you know, this left half of the rectangle, the algebra associated to the right half of the rectangle, and that additive algebra is equivalent to the algebra that I would have assigned without ever splitting the subregion in half. So what this says is I can take subregions, decompose them into tiny parts, take those local algebras, put them together with this V symbol in the way that I described earlier, and that gives me the operators I would have assigned to that algebra. And so it's a strong form of locality. So in a sense, violations of additivity are going to reflect the existence of non-local operators in the theory. Okay, great. So that's what I wanted to say about the aspects of algebraic quantum field theory that we'll be interested in for this talk. So let's come back to the idea of holographic conformal field theories. Okay, so let's consider a CF key with some n by n matrix degrees of freedom. So you might have in mind something like n equals 4 super Yang nulls with gauge group SUN. Then if we consider that theory at a finite value of n, so you know we just have some finite dimensional matrices, the number of local degrees of freedom is finite, then there's a well-defined Hilbert space, just the Hilbert space of the CFT. And if I take the full operator algebra and I close it into von Neumann algebra, it's just all of the operators acting on the CFT Hilbert space. That's what's called a type 1 von Neumann algebra. Good, so this is what makes sense at finite n. But you know, in a theory where I have a parameter like n that I can dial and increase the local number of degrees of freedom, what can happen is that some of the states and operators in the theories may not survive the large n limit. If I try to define those operators, you know, and I can define them at each value of n as n is getting very large, what I might find is that they don't make any sense when I try to take the large n limit. So I'll describe that in a bit more detail later. But what this means is that there can be dramatic changes in the structure of the Hilbert space and of the operator algebras when we take this large n limit. Good. So let's come to the idea of the single trace algebra. So if we have a theory that has these n by n matrix degrees of freedom, then using the OPE, we can expand, you know, commutators of operators like this. In terms of an expansion in powers of 1 over n. So this is a state dependent algebra that just describes, you know, the algebraic content of the theory. Using the OPE, I can just derive this relation. And so this relates, you know, this operator that's the commutator of these two to, you know, some power series of operators on the right hand side. But in general, what will happen is in these matrix theories is that even if these O1s and O2s are single trace operators, we can get these OKs, these operators out here. The operators out there can be operators that do not survive the large n limit. And so what this means is that when I take the strict large n limit, there are some of the terms in this sum just don't make any sense. And that means that basically we've lost this relation. So the structure of the algebra has actually changed. Okay, good. And so how do we sensibly define an algebra in the large n limit? Okay, so the first thing that we need to do is that if you look at these, you know, these matrix theories, if we consider the expectation values of these single trace operators, those are generically going to be growing linearly with n. So, you know, if we just try to define that operator in the large n limit, its expectation value is going to be infinite, and we're not going to be able to make sense of it at infinite n. But instead, what we can do is just subtract off that expectation value, right? So we just subtract off some number. But once we've done that, we've said something about a state. We've said that we're going to be working essentially in a subspace of states that's close to psi in some sense. And the subtracted single trace operators are the operators that have a well-defined large n limit. Good. And additionally, we might have chosen our state in a nice way, such that it's what I'll call a semi-classical state. It's a state that obeys large n factorization. And so what this means is that if here O left and O right are any finite products of single trace operators, and I have O1, O2 being the commutator of single trace operators, then within correlation functions in states that are, you know, sort of small excitations above psi, within those correlation functions, I can replace O1, O2 by some C number up to order 1 over n corrections. And so when I take the large n limit, I can drop, you know, I can drop all of these order 1 over n corrections, and this gives me an actual algebra for those single trace operators. So this is how we define the algebra in the large n limit. We get a state-dependent algebra, and so for these kind of states, to leading order in 1 over n, the commutators are equivalent to these complex numbers when inserted into correlation functions, in this state psi, or correlation functions between states that have some sort of finite number of single trace operators acting on psi.
So
yeah.
So the commutator in this limit will be equal to a number.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so this is basically the statement of the large n factorization. Yeah, it's, you get some sort of Gaussian theory. Yeah. Yeah.
So this is true for some like generators of this algebra, right? It's not for literally any element.
No. Yeah. It's true for some. Yeah. So these will be like the single trace operators, but of course for finite products of them, they won't exactly obey that. Yeah. Good. Okay. So once we've done this truncation, we've taken, you know, and, you know, which means we've taken n to infinity, which is where we wanted to be to get classical physics in the bulk. Then we can ask, okay, what are the representations of this algebra? Okay, so now I'll describe a well-known construction due to Gelfand, Neymark, and Siegel. So it proceeds as follows. So in the large n limit, these single trace operators form a state-dependent algebra. Remember that the form of their commutator after I truncate the lower order 1 over n terms. That depended on the state psi. The subtraction depended on the state psi. So this algebra certainly depends on the state. If we act that algebra on this state, we can build what's called a GNS Hilbert space. So there's a general theorem that if I have some state and I can act I act this algebra on it, the structure of those sort of small excitations, which I take to be all of the elements of A acting on psi, can actually be completed into a Hilbert space. So I'll call that the GNS Hilbert space. This Hilbert space has a vacuum, which I'll denote by zero psi, and that's just defined to be the state whose correlators reproduce all the correlation functions in psi. Oh, whoops. and in particular, as I mentioned, we're trying to construct representations of this algebra A psi, and so it furnishes a representation. So I can, this pi psi I'm using here is the representation on the GNS Hilbert space of this operator algebra A psi. Here I've put in the double commutant. All that does is close this into a von Neumann algebra. And this defines for me an operator algebra that I'll call M psi. This is the operator algebra that I get in the large n limit. And now I've closed it into a von Neumann algebra. Okay, so that's for the boundary story in the large n limit. Yes?
Yeah, I have a question. As soon as you start taking large n, mm-hmm. Can you still talk about the state psi?
So here I've been cutting corners in my notation a bit. Okay. So what the state psi really is that I have a sequence of finite n theories. I choose a sequence of states. I choose one state in each of those n theories as I'm going, and then this state psi is really sort of the large n limit of that state. No worries. Okay, so what's the bulk side of the story? So the bulk side of the story is nice and simple. It's something that maybe we're all familiar with because we're taking G Newton to zero. So taking G Newton to zero, so here's some more of a philosophical point, is that the quantum gravity state, whatever it is, and we might not know how to describe it, should be described by some classical solution of Einstein's equation. So we believe that, you know, whatever the quantum gravity theory is, if it's got this parameter G Newton and we send it to zero, it had better reproduce the classical solutions to Einstein's equation that we know. Okay, if we quantize perturbations of the bulk fields around that background solution, this gives us a bulk Hilbert space. And so then the algebra of bulk field perturbations is just all of these operators that act on that bulk Hilbert space. So this is the story for the bulk in the G Newton to zero limit. So then now we can come back to the idea of ADS-CFT duality. What does this mean? It means that, you know, in this G Newton to zero limit, which is the n to infinity limit of ADS-CFT, there's an equivalence between the GNS Hilbert space on the boundary and the Hilbert space of small excitations in the bulk around the classical solution that corresponded to the state psi. And if those Hilbert spaces agree, then we also need to identify the operator algebras acting on them. And this is actually a very familiar statement to people who've studied ADS-CFT. This is just the statement of global reconstruction. If I know everything about the boundary theory, then I know everything about the bulk theory. This is just the statement. Okay. So if we've identified the large algebras, you know, each one of those large algebras associated to the full boundary or associated to the full bulk has a bunch of subalgebras within it. And so if we have an identification of the large algebras, there should be some identification of the subalgebras. And in particular, the identification of subalgebras has to have a very specific structure, because the bulk theory is a theory of quantum fields in curved space. So in particular, we have things like a local equation of motion for that theory, and we have causality in the bulk. And this gives us very specific relations between the operator algebras that describe the bulk theory. So we want to understand, how is it possible that the boundary theory can reproduce all of this special structure of the bulk subalgebras? So, you know, this mapping between boundary and bulk algebras has to be able to reproduce all of those properties that we know for the bulk algebra, and we should be able to check on both sides. Okay, so I've been mentioning that, you know, the bulk is just some nice quantum fields on curved space, so it has some nice structure that we think we understand. So in particular, we can define, if we take a single Cauchy slice of the bulk, the full algebra of bulk fields is defined on a single Cauchy slice.
So
yes.
Isn't the BART supposed to be quantum gravity? So it's not the EFT.
Sorry, so here I've taken the G Newton to zero limit. So that. Yeah, so I want to quantize small fluctuations about that. The background is fixed. But I can have gravitons.
Small fluctuation will contain gravitational fluctuations.
Sorry?
So in quantum gravity, you will have fluctuations of the geometry.
Right, right. It's a, yeah.
So these fluctuations of the geometry are not just this one.
No. Those are not in EFT, and we don't have access to those fluctuations. So like we can have perturbative fluctuations of the graviton, but we can't allow them to back react on the geometry.
Don't you want your CFT to be able to?
Oh yes, of course. Ultimately, yeah.
This description should be incomplete.
Yeah, this description is incomplete, and that's because we've lost information in going to the large end limit.
And you should see it on your CFT that you're missing something.
Yes. Yeah. So we're going to see that the CFT has a very strange structure. That, well, the n equals infinity CFT, yeah, which I should put in quotations. Good. Any other questions at this point?
Maybe just clarifying, since that are my question. EFT, so I should think of just classical gravity at that point. But is there any quantumness to it? Like, there are other fields?
Yeah, the other fields can be quantized as long as they're small perturbations that I'm not going to allow to back react on the geometry. The thing is, the background geometry does have to be fixed.
Okay.
And so that's something we're definitely missing, for sure.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is the core of quantum gravity.
Yes. That's true. Yeah. So ultimately we want to understand that, but what we believe is that whatever the quantum gravity theory is, we hope that it can be defined at any value of finite value of G Newton. And we believe that, you know, if we can define, you know, that sequence of quantum gravity theories at different values of G Newton in a particular limit where G Newton goes to zero, we should recover this sort of perturbative physics around a fixed background solution.
Don't you want to understand at least the first deformation of how the EFT goes into quantum gravity? I mean, because we know how to describe EFT, right? So the interesting thing about the conjecture is access to a bit of quantum gravity, just a little bit.
So
how would you, I mean, maybe it's beyond what you're doing there.
So here the hope is that we can think of this as being, you know, we get some theory that describes the large n limit, and then we would want to add these 1 over n corrections to it and hope that that gives us access to some quantum gravity quantities.
Do you understand this deformation?
So in certain cases we can understand the deformation. In certain cases, we can understand a little bit of the deformation of how that sort of deforms the structure of the algebras. There's this work of Witten and Chandrasekhar and Pennington Longo, and that's had many follow-ups. That has something to say about that. But today we're more asking, you know, how do we get this higher dimensional theory out of the lower dimensional theory to begin with, and in particular. What we get is a local theory in the bulk, but you know, presumably whatever the quantum gravity theory is at finite values of G Newton is not some local field theory, and so we want to understand how, you know, so the CFT the CFT at finite n is supposed to describe that quantum gravity theory at finite G Newton, which will not be a local theory, but we want to understand what is it about the CFT that allows it in the large n limit to describe local bulk physics. Yes, but those are great questions that we would love to be able to answer. Yeah. unfortunately, I won't be able to do it today. Okay, good. So what we have access to in this limit is a local bulk EFT. The full algebra of fields is defined on a single Cauchy slice. And so if it's a local bulk EFT, it means that we can assign algebras to any subregions of those slices. So in particular, you know, here if I draw a Cauchy slice for the bulk, it's described by an algebra that's n tilde psi. If I decompose that slice into these spatial subregions that look like this, I should be able to, you know, assign a subalgebra to this region that I've done with a Gothic B and its complement. And we want to understand how can we identify those algebras in the boundary theory in a way that's consistent with this local bulk EFT. Okay, good. And so in particular, one sort of necessary condition is that if this is a local relativistic theory, then these subalgebras associated to local subregions are what's called type 3-1 von Neumann algebras. And so what this means is that for every one of, for every possible, subregion of this Cauchy slice that I can take, I need to be able to find an emergent type 3-1 algebra in the boundary that's associated to each of those subregions. Okay, and so what are we missing in the CFT? So you could phrase this in different ways, but what are we missing in the CFT? That there's going to be a weird property of the CFT that allows us to reproduce this structure. Okay, good. So let's consider the single trace operators at large n. So if we take, a single trace operator, maybe this one, then at finite n, if we want to consider this operator at a different value of time, well, how do we get there? Well, this is a conformal field theory. It has some Hamiltonian. We can solve the Heisenberg equations of motion and just evolve this operator here. Alternatively, the operator content of the theory can all be defined on the t equals 0 Cauchy slice. So we can find a complete set of operators. And this operator at finite time can be just decomposed in terms of that complete set of operators. OK, so this relates a time-evolved single trace operator to some sum of potentially very complicated operators defined on the t equals 0 slice. Good. But what happens when we take if I have a complete basis of operators here, it's going to include multi-trace CFT operators that don't survive the large n limit. And so in particular, what this means is that when we take the n goes to infinity limit, well, this side remains well-defined. We can define it through its correlation functions. Its correlation functions in states that we're interested in remain well-defined. So we can define that sensibly in the large n limit. But the multi-trace operators appearing in this decomposition will not have a nice large n limit. And so what that means is that this left-hand side is well-defined, but we can't think of it as being written in terms of either of these equations here on the right. So we've lost an algebraic relation that related V of t to this complete basis of operators. And in fact, the single trace algebra is described by what's called a generalized free field theory. This is a field theory that has no local Hamiltonian. So that's something that we've lost by taking the large n limit. We've thrown out the idea of a local Hamiltonian on the boundary. And so I should mention, the fact that this should be a generalized free field theory was noticed a long time ago by looking at boundary limits of bulk fields by Deutsch and Rarin. Okay, so generalized free field theories are strange. One thing I've been trying to emphasize is that, so if we consider this causal diamond here, then if there's a subregion A1, which is a Cauchy slice of that diamond, and we have another Cauchy slice A2. So usually in quantum field theory, we can use the equation of motion to evolve this A2, any operators on A2 to operators on A1, and conclude that those algebras are the same. But for generalized free fields, this is not the case. And another example that's going to be important for this talk is consider some causally incomplete subregion like this. So here I've cut out a piece of the subregion, so it's causally incomplete. So usually in quantum field theory, this we can just look at a Cauchy slice on this, and we can extend the evolution of the Cauchy slice as far as we can go. And we'd conclude that the algebra of these red regions is the same as the algebra of that diamond. Again, this is something that fails to be true in the large n limit for the single trace operator. Yeah.
The question about the definition of DFF, it's just that the two-point function determines the correlation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Great.
With no more.
Yeah, with no higher order contractions needed. Yeah. Good. Good. So let's come back to the idea of global reconstruction. Well, global reconstruction is then actually an equivalence between this bulk Cauchy slice that I have here that had this algebra M tilde and these boundary generalized free field operators that are defined on the entire boundary space-time. Okay, so we have to think about operators extended on the space-time here. We can't just pick a Cauchy slice of the boundary. That's what we've lost by going to the large n limit. Good. Okay. So let me describe the idea of subalgebra subregion duality. The GFF's on the boundary, yeah. And the bulk still has a nice local equation of motion because we're in this EFT limit. Yeah.
So it's not possible to restrict to any subset of the boundary. You have to take the full boundary.
So if I want to get, so there are various things that can show up. So in the example I've drawn, you could actually restrict to a time band of sufficiently large temporal width and you'd be fine. But in general, you might need the entire boundary. Yeah, good. You certainly can't do just a time slice though. You'll need some finite extent in time. Good, okay. So in the large n limit of the CFT, we have a bunch of additional type 3.1 subalgebras that appear. So we had all these algebras that were equivalent in the finite n theory, and now when we take the large n limit, they're actually no longer equivalent to each other. So there's a sense in which we have a bunch more of these emergent type 3.1 algebras appearing. That's great, because on the gravity side, we have an extra dimension. So if we want to cover all of those regions, we had better have a bunch of extra type 3.1 algebras from the boundary perspective. So in particular, what we propose is that, you know, the algebra of local bulk operators in each causally complete bulk subregion, which I'll denote with this Gothic B, that's always dual to some emergent type 3.1 subalgebra in the large n limit of the CFT. So in particular, if I take my bulk field operators and restrict them to this subregion to generate some von Neumann algebra in the bulk, I can always find some y within this this large n limit of the boundary algebra that is an equivalent algebra to that region B. And so this is a generalization of the RT surface formalization of subregion duality. It's going to give us access to more general subregions B. It's going to give us access to more general subregions B using the fact that we have a bunch more algebras on the boundary than we would have expected just from the finite n theory. Okay. But there's weird things that happen in this large n limit. And one thing that happens is assigning algebras to subregions. There are sort of two natural ways to do it. So there's two natural ways to do it. So imagine that we have some subregion R on the boundary theory. There are two ways that we can define what we mean by the large n limit of that local algebra. So the first way is we can just look in the finite n theory, that the finite n theory, we can restrict operators to operators in that region. And then what we can do is keep all of the operators that were in this subalgebra of the finite n theory, keep all the ones that have well-defined correlation functions in the set psi, and then represent them on the GNS Hilbert space. So I'm going to call that algebra X sub R. The alternative thing that we could do is we could just take the large n limits of the boundary theory. We get that algebra M sub psi that I've been talking about for the most time, and then restrict those operators to this region R hat, which is this causal completion of R. Okay, so good. So what I want to so this is essentially like a statement that the order of limits when we're taking the large n limits is important. So what we've done here.
Are you talking about subalgebra of the bulk or the boundary?
Boundary, this is all boundary, yeah.
So
yeah.
The space-time region, R is a boundary region?
Yes, a boundary region, yeah.
Because you said, okay.
Yeah, sorry, yeah, this is all boundary, this discussion, yeah.
I thought you wanted to have, but you also want.
Yeah, so we're going to map these into the bulk, and what we'll see is that these two different algebras, in general, can give us two different bulk subregions. Good. So we can think about this as sort of a non-commutativity in the large n limit. So what I've done here is in the finite n theory, I've done the spatial restriction. I've restricted to the region R and restricted to operators there. Then I've taken the large n limit and represented on the GNS Hilbert space and all that stuff. Whereas in this case, what I've done is first I just take the large n limit to get the generalized free field theory. And then after taking the large n limit, I do the space-time restriction to the subregion R. And what we'll see is in general that those two procedures don't commute. These operator algebras can be different. You can go and explicitly compute it within the generalized free field theory and see that this is the case. So one thing I should mention is that you can give an explicit characterization. So this y of r, this is just sort of what I meant by that, is that I take a single trace operator O, I represent it on the GNS Hilbert space, and then I say, wait, restrict to the operators that are in this region R hat. Alternatively, you can argue from the JLMS equivalence of bulk and boundary modular flows that this algebra X sub R should actually be described that I take single trace operators just in the region R, so just on like a single time slice of the region R, and then I evolve them with modular flow, and I use that to define the algebra.
Just one question, maybe.
Yeah.
the fact that these two aren't the same is related to what you were saying about the GFF story with the causal diamonds not being.
Yeah. So it's certainly related to that. And I should hopefully give an example that makes that clear. Yeah, I'm pretty sure I put it in. Okay, good. So by definition, this algebra X sub R contains the algebra Y sub R, but in general, these are not going to be equal. Good. And so what I'll propose, that wasn't supposed to come up then, what I'll propose is that XR is dual to the entanglement wedge, and YR is dual to the causal wedge. So we get these two different boundary algebras, and those algebras are different. But in the bulk, we can understand this geometrically from the fact that YR is equivalent to an algebra in a smaller subregion of the bulk than XR. Good. Okay, so now I have a, oh, now it's gone. Okay. So I have a different, how do we define the bulk subregions that are the duals of these algebras? Okay, so the procedure takes four steps. The first step is to use the global reconstruction to give us some handle on what we mean by the bulk. So we write down the field phi of x, you know, just schematically, that imagine that's our field, in terms of these generalized free field theory modes that are supported on the entire boundary. So this is the global reconstruction. And then now we just talk about the boundary. What we do is we can expand the generalized free field in terms of localized modes, those that are localized to the algebra X sub R and those associated to its commutant. And then we can just compute a change of basis from global generalized free field modes to localized generalized free field modes. This is just a generalization of the Bogolyubov transform. And then we can ask, using this expansion in terms of global modes, let's write phi of x in terms of these localized modes. And we define the bulk dual of the algebra to be the set of points x such that this operator phi of x, when written in terms of this basis of modes, has no overlap with the commutant modes. So this defines the bulk dual subregion. It does it with a boundary only procedure. The only handle on the bulk we needed was our original global definition of phi of x. And in particular, what we see is that this RT surface emerges from these boundary algebras. Okay, so let me first give some examples that are covered by subregion-subregion duality. So here I'm gonna draw Minkowski boundary and a time slice of Poincaré ADS. Yes. Yeah. So we don't use any extremal surface prescription or anything like that. All we say is that we can decompose the boundary algebra in terms of these things, and then we ask what are the bulk operators that have no overlap with this commutant algebra.
And can you use this for both of the algebras you're defining on the last?
For both the Y and X algebras, yes. Yeah. Yeah, we can do it. The explicit computations in a lot of cases are hard, so I'll explain the computations that we can do explicitly.
Yeah.
But we believe this is a general structure.
It's going to pick out either the extreme surface.
Exactly. Yeah, it's either going to, yeah, it picks out either the causal domain, if you will, or the extremal surface. Yeah. Good.
When you say no overlap, do you allow other J Newton correction?
So here I'm not going to allow order G Newton corrections, but I think, sorry?
You mean exactly zero overlap with the J
program. Oh, sorry, I mean exactly zero overlap. Good. Yeah, G Newton is zero, so yes, yeah, so yeah, good. So I think, yeah, trying to generalize these is an interesting thing, but it's not something I know how to do yet. Okay, great. Okay, so the Minkowski boundary and the time slice of Poincaré ADS. So that's what I'll draw. So for example, let's draw a half space. Here we have a Rindler wedge that looks like this. You know, it's the causal completion of that half line. And so what we do is, we can decompose a generalized free field in terms of operators associated to this region R and operators associated to the other region that I didn't draw, which would be the diamond on that side. And what we find is that in either case, in this case, the X and the Y algebras agree. And that can be understood from the fact that the modular flow is actually just a local flow in this case, right? So the modular flow is just this Rindler boost here. And so what that means is that we actually don't get any extra operators by using modular evolution rather than just restricting to the subregion that was covered. Okay. And so lo and behold, what you find is that the bulk is, here this is a time slice of Poincaré ADS. You know, it's exactly half of this bulk time slice, and of course it's causal completion in the bulk. And again, here this X of R and Y of R, probably should be R, not R hat, algebras are equivalent. So okay, another example that we can do where we can do explicit computations easily is the following. Let's take an interval like this, whose causal completion is this diamond. That's dual in the bulk to a region that looks like this, within this semicircle. And again, what we find is that that's the bulk dual for both XR and YR because those algebras are equivalent. Again, for conformal theory, in this the algebra associated for the modular flow for the interval is just a local flow. Okay, good. So we can reproduce these, sort of prototypical examples of subregion duality using the procedure I outlined a couple of slides ago. So let's consider a more non-trivial example. Let's consider a region that's the union of, this shifted left Rindler wedge that I've shifted a little bit to the left and a right Rindler wedge that I've shifted to the right. Good. So in this case, what we find is that the algebras are actually inequivalent. So if we do the procedure using this Y of R union S, where S is this sort of shifted left Rindler wedge and R is this shifted right Rindler wedge, then what we find is that the bulk dual defined in that way is actually just sort of the causal wedge of that region, it's the union of the entanglement wedges associated to R and to S separately. Whereas if we do the procedure where we use the modular flow rather than just restricting to the subregion, we find that the bulk dual is actually everything outside of this semicircle. And so what we find here is that this entanglement wedge exceeds the causal wedge, and exactly because the boundary algebra here is a bigger algebra than this algebra Y in this case. And let me just emphasize, this is the first example. Oh, sorry. So the entanglement wedge exceeds the causal wedge in this case. And this is the first example of the additivity anomaly that we've seen in this talk. So in particular, this is a really simple setup with vacuum ADS. These XR and XS algebras, they were equivalent to the Y algebra, the causal wedge algebras when we were considering single subregions. But when we consider this union of two subregions, they're different. So this is the additive algebra is dual to this bulk region here, and the non-additive algebra is dual to this much larger bulk region.
Sorry.
Yes.
Could I instead consider on the boundary the Haag dual region? So consider in the middle the diamond.
Mm-hmm.
That would have been dual to what you wrote in the RAM.
Right, right.
And then you could just have used Haag in the bulk to extract that the entanglement wedge would have been the region outside.
Right, right. Yeah. So this. So that's the thing, is that these entanglement wedge algebras are supposed to obey Haag duality. Whereas these additive algebras will not. Yes, that's true. So if you take, this is sort of built into the argument, because if I take this diamond, then what do I know? Is I know the modular operator for that diamond. The modular operator for an algebra is the inverse of the modular operator for the commutant algebra. And so you can use that to deduce what is the modular operator for the commutant algebra. And this is the commutant algebra of that interval region, so you can deduce that. Yeah, that's true.
But then is it true that XR union S is not additive? So it's not equal to XR?
Exactly. It's not additive. Yeah. Yeah. So this algebra is properly contains this algebra. It's bigger by it has operators that are not in this additive algebra.
Is it just a version of algebraic version of strong subadditivity? The fact that there are some limits that saturate, some Markov properties, and some other that don't? Can you just think of that as an inequality? Because you still have a lower bound, right? Which is one.
Right. Yeah. So certainly we know that this algebra has to be bigger than Y.
Right.
So
you're violating additivity, but entropy, for instance, is not necessarily additive. It satisfies strong.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And so yeah. So the fact that entropy is not additive is what is is sort of a bulk reason that's going to tell us that the boundary theory had to not be additive to begin with, because otherwise, you know, these bulk surfaces are not additive in this sense. Yeah, so that's true. Yeah.
Just clarify, these are all still von Neumann algebras, I guess.
Yeah, sorry. Everything I write down here is von Neumann algebras. I should have made that more explicit, but yes. Yeah, good. Yeah. Okay. Good. Okay, so here's another, you know, quick example. If I consider two overlapping regions, I get their duals that look like this. But of course, on the boundary, we know that that's dual if we had taken this large interval first, we would have gotten this bigger boundary subregion. And in particular, we would have ended up with, you know, a larger bulk subregion there. And if I take the additive algebra, I only have access to this region below the dotted lines. But with the non-additive algebra, I get the larger region. Okay. One thing you can do is, you know, in the bulk, the difference between the additive and non-additive algebras is literally just that I have a bigger space. I have a bigger spatial subregion that I have access to. So one thing you can do is just compute the difference of volumes of the duals of the different algebras, and you'll get some answer. And so in particular, you know, if I take my intervals here to be intervals of width 2a and their centers are separated by 2b, then I can compute this difference here. It's not important what that formula is. All that's important is that when b is 0 and these regions completely overlap, this volume goes to 0, and then it remains finite as I pull the regions apart. And that will be important later. OK, another example that's interesting happens with the BTZ black hole. So in this case, let's consider an entire copy of the left CFT, but an angular interval of width 2w on the right CFT. So in that case, the additive algebra gives us access to, you know, sort of the entire left part of the bulk. This is a time slice of BTZ. And it gives us access to part of the right part of the bulk. But we don't have access to any operators behind the horizon. Whereas if we consider the non-additive algebra, then with the bulk dual ends up being this larger, the domain of dependence of this larger region in the bulk that looks like this. And this gives us some access to operators inside the black hole. Good. In particular, you can go and compute the difference of volumes. This is a volumes that have been computed in the complexity literature, and find that it's equal to this. Okay. So I said that we'd have access to more general bulk subregions. What are those more general bulk subregions? Well, we want to have access to bulk subregions that are not bounded, you know, that maybe don't have near boundary points or are not bounded by an extremal surface. So, you know, like this pink region here, we'd like to know what's the boundary dual of the operator algebra in that region. So what's key here is that even if we have a non-causally complete boundary space-time region, we can still just restrict the generalized free field to that region and define an algebra. These algebras are dual to the causal domain of that region R. This is the bulk causal completion of the causal wedge of R, where I don't do any boundary causal completion. Good. So one region we can consider is something called a time band, which is just a space-time subregion of the boundary that contains a complete Cauchy slice. In the generalized free field theory, this is actually a non-trivial subalgebra. It doesn't give us all of the operators. We can build up this algebra. So these restricted Y algebras are additive. So we can build them up by covering this region with a bunch of diamonds. And if we assume that the bulk theory obeys additivity, then it allows us to deduce the bulk dual, which contains all of the near boundary points, you know, anywhere in this, anywhere on the boundary near this time band that I've drawn here. And I'll just mention this is similar to the approach of differential entropy that was pioneered in these papers that tells us about the area of general bulk surfaces. So we want to describe, you know, regions bounded by more general bulk surfaces than extremal surfaces. So you know, it's nice that in this construction we can take an approach that's similar to that. Okay, so for example, you know, I'll just do one very simple example. If you take vacuum ADS 3, its bulk dual of one diamond is some region that looks like this. If we take the union of a bunch of diamonds around the circle, we can form a time band, and the dual is sort of the exterior of this hole that we get here. Again, we can compute the volume, which is the volume of the hole, so of the maximal volume time slice of this blue cone that's drawn in the bulk here. And what we find is that, you know, it's this difference of volumes is non-zero when we have the anomaly, and it's zero when we don't. Okay, so let's come to the applications of this anomaly. Yes.
So what are the values assigned to the points?
So that's a good question. that's a good question. It seems that in these generalized free field theories, removing points has much more dramatic consequences than it does in you know, usual quantum field theories. I think I would say, you know,
the limit, no? I mean, when up and set and then two different points. Okay, so you say you don't know this answer.
No, yeah, so this I don't know, but it seems like there's a way to define a non-trivial algebra to a point. These constructions are suggesting. I mean, yeah, you do have to define it in this limiting way, but yeah, it's something that I'm certainly less sure about. Yeah.
Is there a conjecture? Where is the algebra? You go back to the
right
object of having quantum gravity. It's,
yeah.
The whole point of quantum gravity is what's the point?
Right.
And so if you have an answer in the larger limit, that's kind of interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. Maybe we should talk offline. Yeah, I think there is a way, but yeah, it's not something I fully understand. Yeah. Great. Okay. Yeah.
Is it possible to get the boundary subalgebra of the corresponding to the commutant of the bulk subalgebra corresponding to the central region?
Yeah. So the commutant of that time band algebra, since we know the bulk dual of the time band, and the bulk theories that we consider, if they obey additivity, or sorry, if they obey Hogg duality, then we know from the bulk that is the commutant. Explicitly describing that commutant in boundary language is very difficult, though. So we can say, yes, it's the commutant of the time band algebra. Explicitly describing it is tough. Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry. I was just going to say, so the natural extension of that question is if you can construct a subregion inside of that hole, I guess, on the boundary. But those operators are supposed to be very complex, so I guess maybe they're not really captured by this construction. When you take the larger limit, and your correlators are based on a finite number of.
Right. So. So I think, you know, we can still talk about operators inside the horizons of black holes and things like this that we expect to be complex, and in a sense, I think the answer to this is that if you remember that we had those V of T operators. Like if we do the single trace operators in the large n limit, they include time evolution for all times. So in principle, there can be these exponentially complex operators in the algebra, but I can't think of them as operators on any particular time slice. But it's not something that's fully understood. That's actually related to this point.
Why any finite time band?
So, yeah, sorry, yeah. Maybe let me do this example, and hopefully we'll answer your question. Yeah, good, was there a question?
No, I had the same exact question.
Okay, good. Okay, because I'll do a toy model of a black hole, if you will. Okay, good. So I just wanted to say the reason I flashed all those volumes up there is that the difference of volumes of bulk subregions seems to be a good measure for the additivity anomaly, in the sense that, you know, this difference of volumes is positive semi-definite, which sort of reflects the fact that this is always an inclusion, and the volumes are only equal when the algebras agree. You know, these bulk volumes have been argued to be dual to some notion of complexity in the boundary theory. As far as I understand, those notions of complexity make sense in the finite n theory, and I don't entirely know how to you know, generalize that into this limit. But it seems like there's some that this additivity anomaly somehow, you know, gives a large n signature of the complexity discussion. And so, to maybe convince you that maybe that's not crazy, let's consider an example, which I'll say is my toy model of a black hole. So consider two disjoint angular integrals for a holographic CFT that's defined on a circle. This is a setup And so if I have, you know, these regions R1 and R2, they're dual to these this purple regions that I've drawn here. And this is a setup. They're individually dual to those regions. This is a setup that has a Python's lunch at G Newton equals zero, in the sense that this is, you know, this is an extremal surface that's homologous to the regions R1 union R2, but it's not the minimal area extremal surface. The minimal area extremal surface is this one. And so this setup has this Python's lunch in the sense that we have these competing extremal surfaces, even at G Newton equals zero. And moreover, the additive algebra of R1 and R2 exactly gives me access to this sort of causal wedge region here that is not connected, whereas the non-additive algebra gives me access to these operators deep in the bulk near this E that I don't have access to on that side. So in some sense, these operators in the lunch are not in the additive algebra, even though they're in the algebra constructed in the other way, this X algebra. So there's some sense in which there's a large N notion of complexity, but what that is, I don't actually know. If you have any ideas, I'd be very happy to talk. Good. Since I'm running out of time, let me skip the application to quantum error correction. Essentially, quantum error correction is all about delocalization of quantum information. And as I mentioned, this violation of additivity is sort of this algebraic version of delocalization of the information. So I think that the fact that in the large N limit where we have a classical bulk, that we have this additivity anomaly for those large N algebras is something that underlies the success of these quantum error correction models. One can also argue that the additivity anomaly gives an avenue to avoid these arguments of Harlow and Uguri that get rid of preclude the existence of global symmetries in the bulk. This allows for global symmetries to emerge in the G Newton goes to zero limit, which of course is with quantum gravity turned off, so maybe it's not so surprising. Yes.
Why?
Essentially because their argument says is that I can't come up with a boundary operator that's going to implement the global symmetry in the bulk, such that it acts non-trivially on this operator in the center of the bulk. And the way that they conclude that is by using entanglement wedge reconstruction. They say I can write the symmetry operator as a boundary operator here times a boundary operator here times a boundary operator here times a boundary operator here. And because none of those operators can reach this operator in the center, there's no operator that transforms. But of course, what we've just learned is that the algebra of this full region is the algebra to describe. If I take the algebras of those four regions and put them together, I actually don't get the full algebra. I have this additivity anomaly. And so it provides this avenue to avoid their arguments.
Well, you get the full one at the constant slice in the boundary.
Yeah, if I take a full constant slice of the boundary, then yes, I get the full algebra. If I try to decompose that into a bunch of subregions on that and add those algebras together, I don't get the full bulk. So the fact that I don't get the full bulk, even though right, these four intervals are covering the entire boundary. So if the bulk symmetry operator is an operator that's generated non-additively on the boundary, then this avoids the arguments. Yeah. Okay, and then let me come to the idea of the connected wedge theorem. So hopefully many of you are familiar with this setup. So this is a theorem that concerns the relationship between boundary entanglement structure and bulk causal structure. In particular, there are very interesting cases where you consider a configuration of input points, these C1, C2, output points, R1 and R2, where the boundary scattering is impossible. I can't have C1 and C2 meet up and then separately go off to R1 and R2, but bulk scattering is there. And so what these authors did, one of whom is here, is argue that this bulk scattering through an equivalence of quantum tasks implies there's a large boundary mutual information between this region V1 and this region V2. This implies that the entanglement wedge is connected, and in particular with the language I've introduced today, it implies that we have this additivity anomaly. So if we take this from a different approach, we imagine that we started just studying this theory in vacuum, this theorem in vacuum. Well, in vacuum, we can just compute both sides. We can just compute what's the scattering region, what are the entanglement wedges. And in that case, you can verify the CWT. But there's an interesting thing, which is that the scattering region is actually equivalent to an intersection of entanglement wedges. And so in particular, in the vacuum, you can phrase the connected wedge theorem as this intersection of entanglement wedges. Yeah, intersection of entanglement wedges is non-empty when we have the additivity anomaly for those intervals V1 and V2. This can then be translated using this idea of subalgebra subregion duality into a pure boundary statement. So we can turn this into a pure boundary statement about the structure of the large N limit of holographic theories. It relates what I'm calling an intersection anomaly. If you took the geometric intersection of all of these V's and W's, the intersection would be zero. So that says that there, you know, if you obeyed this intersection property, then you'd say, hey, I don't have any operators that are in all of those regions. But here we get an intersection anomaly. Okay, and so let me just quickly say that potentially one could hope that maybe one can generalize the connected wedge theorem in a way that this statement of the theorem in terms of intersections of entanglement wedges rather than in terms of scattering regions holds outside of vacuum. So this is a stronger version of the connected wedge theorem in the forward direction because this region, that's the intersection of entanglement wedges, is actually bigger whenever the bulk obeys the null than the scattering region whenever the bulk obeys the null curvature condition. So you can actually see this in an argument from the May, Pennington, and Source paper. That means that in the backwards direction, it's a weaker statement, which is great because that helps us evade the counterexample to the converse of the connected wedge theorems. And so this point here is really just for the experts on this. Essentially, because this region is defined in terms of these entanglement wedges, these entanglement wedges are cut off by null rays coming from the complementary points. So when I put in positive energy and those null rays get delayed, this region SE actually grows, whereas S would have shrunk. And so this is how it avoids that counterexample. Okay, so since I'm over time, let me just quickly say one thing we've discussed at length that would be interesting. It'd be interesting to understand if we can understand quantum extremal surfaces and islands and things like that from the algebraic definition of the dual. Certainly that will require studying G. Newton corrections. It'd be interesting if we can construct the differential entropy from an algebraic quantity defined from building up these time bands with diamonds. It'd be interesting to explore this relationship between the additivity anomaly and complexity. And in particular, does it let us define some generalized notion of complexity in terms of algebra inclusions directly in the large N limit? And finally, you know, if this conjectured generalization of the conjectured wedge theorem is true, can we prove it? So thanks for your time.
Well, I'm interested in the last part of connected wedge theorem.
Oh yeah.
So, do you mean in the counter example, actually the relevant central region is actually larger?
Yeah. So if I remember that the counter example correctly, you consider some intervals that are, you know, that are just barely connected, essentially. And then if I put in any positive energy coming in there, right? So in that case, I have these null rays coming in and I need them to be able to meet and scatter and then come out. So it's a question about rays that are coming from the regions of B, V1 union V2. It's a question about null rays coming from that regions, whether they can meet and then get out into W1 and W2. Whereas when you talk about the entanglement wedges, because entanglement wedges obey complementary recovery, the question that you're asking instead is a different question, not whether these null rays can get from the regions, meet, and come out. It's, are there any regions from the complement, are there any rays from the complementary region that will interfere with this sort of scattering process? And so those null rays also get delayed, and that's what causes this region SE to grow rather than the S region, which is defined in a different way, which shrinks. Yeah.
If there are no further questions, as we have a lot during the talk, let's thank the speaker.